Hello and welcome to You Made Me Watch That, where two film studies professors aim to expand each other's cinematic knowledge one recommendation at a time. I am your co-host, Wickham Catesby Flanagan.
I am your co-host, Colleen Kennedy Carpot.
This episode, we are discussing the immortal, the fabulous, America's sweetheart.
What?
Charlie Kaufman.
Charlie Kaufman. Focusing on my recommendation of the new Netflix animated film, Orion and the Dark.
And my recommendation of Anomalisa. By process of elimination, the one Charlie Kaufman film that you did not seem to have seen.
I also haven't seen Human Nature, actually.
Which I've not seen Human Nature
I didn't
either.
Realize that he wrote it, but that was directed by Michel Gondry.
Another Michel Gondry.
Yes. Another collaboration between, of course, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is the more famous of the two. But anyway, yeah. I mean, I really wanted you to see Orion in the Dark.
Yes.
Because it is such a Charlie Kaufman movie, but you know, geared to kids, and just the opening just sells it as exactly what it is. And
when you think of movies for children, you think of Charlie Kaufman.
No, well, I mean, that's sort of why I thought this is Charlie Kaufman. So I prioritized it. I roped my children into watching it with me because it's like, oh, it's a new film. I had to sort of pitch it to them. And mommy, why do you want to watch it? They said, well, because the screenwriter is very famous. Oh, what has he done? Like, nothing you can see.
Maybe,
and Anomalisa would also be one
they
cannot see. Not yet. Eventually.
Did Spike Jones do that?
Spike Jones did being John Malkovich, yes.
So he would write scripts, but then he got into directing with Synecdoche, New York. That was his directorial debut.
Yes.
A very divisive film.
Apparently.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then
I liked it.
I did too.
I mean,
I think we like Charlie Kaufman in general. I would say, I don't know how you would classify him, just sort of interesting, absurd or surreal ideas, usually about, or premises and concepts, usually about sort of human nature and existential quandaries with people dealing with these things, taken to some sort of weird meta extreme.
Yeah. Severe neuroses.
Severe neuroses, but in different... In different contexts, relationships,
different contexts,
artists, you know.
Well, yeah, I think he does really, really well with narrating creative process.
Yes.
And thought processes more generally, which is something that we see in Orion in the Dark, actually.
He feels very in his work.
Yes.
In the sense that he is often dissecting his own process as he's writing these things.
Yeah, I mean, for my money, Adaptation, which he wrote and Spike Jones
and he's
directed.
In quote unquote.
I mean, yes, he writes himself into the film, and it really just shows writer's block, especially, but also
sort of, Meryl Streep getting high.
Well, I mean, there's a lot going for Adaptation.
Yes, it's hard to parse a lot of his films.
Yes, I mean, there's no like thumbnail sketch that really does justice to any of the films that he does.
Maybe Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. That's pretty easy to explain.
I mean, that there's a very it's a like a sci-fi premise.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, Adaptation is a little different. I mean, the premise there is very simple. I mean, he's a screenwriter who is trying to adapt a book.
Being John Malkovich is very simple too. It's in the title.
I guess, yeah. But then, you know, as soon as you get into any of the mechanisms, you're there for 5 minutes and you haven't actually gotten to the parts that you really like.
Right.
Catherine Keener.
But Malkovich anyway, going inside his own head. That's the highlight.
Malkovich.
Malkovich, Malkovich.
Oh,
here's my issue or my conundrum with Charlie Kaufman is that he's often trying to grapple with, again, something very human, something very personal, something that these neuroses or anxieties or existential dread, obviously I'm into that component of it, that he is often dealing with. But because his ideas are so absurd or surreal or meta, referring back to the creative process, there is this disconnect, I feel, between that aspect of it, the kind of more, I guess, postmodern components of his script versus him trying to tie them into some sort of human emotion characterization, these kinds of things. And I think Being John Malkovich is actually a great example. I don't particularly like that movie. Not because I think it's bad. I think it's an awesome idea. I think, you know, Charlie Kaufman's ideas are always great. But by the end, this idea of like, which ties nicely into Anomalisa, by the end, this idea of like puppeteering people And John Cusack becomes a master puppeteer or some nonsense. And it, like, I have no connection to the protagonist at a certain point in that movie because it gets so into the mechanisms by which the premise is, like, he takes things to such a kind of absurd level and often, you know, deliberately kind of experimental level, that it's very difficult to grapple with any kind of human connection that maybe he's going for. And it, and Synecdoche, New York, I think one of the reasons why it's so divisive is that, divisive? Okay.
Tomato, tomato.
Is that fundamentally it's a movie that makes you want to feel for Philip Seymour Hoffman's character.
Yeah.
But that whole movie is about like art inside of art inside of art and the creative process and time dilations and people playing other people as characters. And it's so bogged down in the minutiae of like, yes, this meta opus that Charlie Kaufman is making that Philip Seymour Hoffman as a character is like barely... It's barely able to register a pulse at a certain point. So there's like these emotional moments with relationships with characters. And you're like, who is this person? Is this the actor playing the person who's playing the actor in the role? Like you get kind of caught up in that stuff. And I think that is something that he's constantly wrestling with. And one reason why I really love I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which is probably my favorite Charlie Kaufman movie. Is that it is so simple relatively of what the emotional stakes are around it. It's a guy who is depressed, who is imagining a fantasy woman that ultimately wants to leave him in his own head. And it's very easy for you to wrap your head around that. And you, once you sort of can grapple with it, everything kind of fits nicely into place, this kind of horror tinge to it, the, you know, obviously deep melancholic motifs in it. Excuse me, Toni Collette. Being insane. Jesse Buckley, FTW.
Yes. You realize that I'm Thinking of Ending Things is one of the films that you very indirectly recommended before the podcast.
I know.
Because this was, I think, early lockdown days when that came out. And, you know, we teach the same students and we were teaching on Zoom. And somebody, I think it might have even been Tylon, now that I think about it, was in my class and your class at the same time, logged in. Wickham Ho just said that this is a really great movie. I said, that sounds great. I'll see you next week. And the next week, he logs in Wickham again. Tylon, I saw it, Hoja. Wickham says you should watch it. It's really good. It's like, are you joking?
Did you know me?
No. I mean, the students were passing along your recommendations to
me. I'm so sorry.
Framing them as recommendations to me. What I have no idea if that's how you phrased it.
I just mean, I wanted everyone to watch it.
Apparently, yes. I mean, this is what they said,
similar
that you wouldn't
lighthouse.
Shut up about it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, The Lighthouse, you told me directly eventually. But I watched it because you recommended it to my students who would then not shut up about it. So that's the legacy you're leaving your classes from pandemic time.
Yeah. I mean, often my recommendations, you know, students don't necessarily go for. I mean, it seems like I'm Thinking of Ending Things is also a bit divisive because it is so.
It's really dark.
Yeah, it's very. It's very dark.
And it's but a little slow for a Charlie Kaufman
it's
film.
It's a lot of them
the
talking
pacing,
in a car.
Yes, yes. Yeah. The pacing is really dragged out, I think, compared to a lot of his other work.
I just love it so much. Like in the context of like the meta, like it's sort of a horror. It has this horror vibe without being a horror film, where it's existential horror. The book that it's based on devolves into more overtly sort of something more horrific.
Hmm.
But Charlie Kaufman replaced that ending with a dance scene. So I obviously appreciate that, if you remember the movie. But there's a part in that movie that I love where essentially, yeah, you don't necessarily know it's all in someone's head without giving it too much away. Not that maybe it reframes it in a different way when you watch it. But one of the characters says to our main character, you don't have to go. And she's like, what are you talking about? He said, you don't have to go forward. And just as a concept of like, you don't have to keep going with this movie. Like, and this something like this I mentioned happens in Green Knight. Like, I just like that concept of the movie acknowledging that we shouldn't keep going with this movie. I think Funny Games also sort of does this of like, why are you still watching?
The Northman also kind of does this. The moment of reckoning on the boat where Anya Taylor-Joy is just like, you escaped. Yeah. I mean, and that's I experienced that as the fork in the road. And then he chooses the dumb meathead option as opposed to the more progressive.
And we're very thankful that he did choose the dumb meathead option. I really appreciate, even despite its darkness, I think it's a fun movie.
I'm thinking of ending things.
Yeah, it's fun.
Let's parse that sentence.
Okay. Anyway.
I'm thinking of ending things.
We're not here to talk about my love
of
that movie.
It's a fun movie.
Anyway, existential
Wickham Flanagan
neuroses. There are fun aspects to it. It's playful.
We're not writing the blurb here.
It's playful use of time and space and
snow.
And snow. At one point she does an impression of Pauline Kael at one point.
I don't remember that.
I believe she is. She has a cigarette inexplicably and she's quoting a review. Because this is all the stuff that's in his head that he wishes his dream girl would quote. No?
Okay.
You're not feeling it.
No.
He doesn't have a good end.
No, and Charlie Kaufman does end up framing dream girls in some sort of eye-rollingly.
Yeah. Well, you want to talk about Anomalisa?
Oh man. Shall we?
So technically.
Or do we start with the kid-friendly one first and then just say that?
Well,
here are the roadblocks.
It's up to you. What are you feeling?
Let's do Anomalisa first. Let's live dangerously.
So technically, first thing with Anomalisa, I love the whole stop motion puppeteering aesthetic that he's sort of bringing over from being John Malkovich.
Yes.
This infatuation with like facsimiles of people.
Mm-hmm.
The conceit that voiced by David Thewlis, this guy going to an academic conference?
This reminded me quite a bit of Up in the Air.
Yes.
And sort of the tone of this like very bland, empty corporate speak. He's like a customer service guru who has a book and he's been invited to speak at a conference of telephone customer service representatives.
Okay, it's just very bland.
Yes.
Okay.
So it reminded me quite a bit of George Clooney's character's side hustle in Up in the Air when he's carrying his backpack around. And so our lead is a very similar sort of empty corporate, but successful.
And also the aesthetic of Up in the Air, this kind of gray.
Yes, it's a hotel room, interstitial space. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously all puppets. And I like the conceit that everyone in the world is the same androgynous puppet, essentially.
Voiced by Tom Noonan.
Yes, who also shows up in Synecdoche, New York. He has this nice cadre of people. David Thewlis is one.
Uh-huh.
There's just the notion that he sees everyone as the same person is both very creepy and also because Tom Noonan has this, they play with his voice to sound both
a little bit.
And
yes.
Masculine.
Yeah. 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 It takes a minute to get used to this.
Like, what is he sounding like? But then is her name Lisa?
Yes.
He runs into Lisa and she is a different person.
Jennifer Jason Leigh, to be specific.
And she has like a scar, right?
Yes.
And he is enamored with her because she emerges as a fully distinctive, this anomaly, Anomalisa, and then there's puppet sex.
Yeah, it's a very bold move to even conceive of a puppet sex movie post-Team America World Police.
You know, it's a subgenre of a subgenre.
I wouldn't even call it a genre, but I'm just sitting here thinking this, okay. I have seen this before. Very different.
Well,
context.
Yeah, Team America, they just blow it up into something so ridiculous. But in Anomalisa's credit, comparatively, it's realistic, for lack of a better word. It's been a while since I've seen the movie.
Okay, all right.
No?
Yeah, I mean, it's not making fun of it. Like,
no.
I mean, the Team
but
America.
But there's an absurdity.
Yes. I mean, all of it's absurd to a certain extent. But anyways, yeah.
And then the horror is, it's a very simple movie, Anomalisa.
It is, yeah.
There's some cool transition stuff, speaking of like Eternal Sunshine, like practical transitions, like they get in one door and it becomes the elevator that goes up. Not too dissimilar to actually like the short, the not Henry Sugar a little bit.
Okay. Yes.
Like these interesting usages of this kind of stop motion tech. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Wes Anderson would be very familiar with that too. And then she eventually becomes one of the many after they have sex.
Yes, of course. Yes. After he has chosen her and he's like blathering on about leaving his wife and just running off with her because she's a real person. And then
she becomes one of the.
Yeah.
And what's the message of the film?
Well, I was going to ask you this because I watched it and I wasn't even like multitasking. I was watching it fairly attentively and I feel like I missed something.
I don't know if you did. I think that's one of the problems with it. And this my wife pointed it out to me that ultimately she felt like she did not like the movie, and she likes Charlie Kaufman in general, but she felt like the movie was essentially a man justifying having an affair. And that Charlie Kaufman is wrestling with this, you know, if he's so personal and he sees the world as this very sort of, you know, he sort of isolates himself probably in this self-aggrandizing way, similarly. And this is a convenient reason to sleep with a random woman while going on a conference.
I guess, yeah. But I mean, like, he does not come, like, that character, is it Stone, I guess, something. But he does not come off well at all.
No.
Like, throughout.
And to the movie's,
throughout.
To the movie's credit, he gives some weird, like, pseudo like self deprecating speech at the end about kind of his philosophy about life to the ad people. The inspirational speech turns sort of dark and cynical.
Yes.
So that's kind of nice. And then it cuts to Anomalisa, who is her own self, kind of riding off into the sunset
with her friend, who now no longer looks like
the
same puppet face. So like there is this clarity that the problem is with him,
right?
Like that, like the movie is very clear.
I think is
yes. To what end? Like what does he? Because he does end up going back home to his wife and son with a very inappropriate gift. So it just, I mean, his own thoughtlessness.
Yeah,
seems to be what's stymieing him. I mean, he's giving these very bland corporate nonsense talks. Obviously like these women, like Lisa and her friend, Emily, I think is the name. Like, so Emily is one of the bland people and Lisa's, you know, capturing his heart, whatever. So, I mean, we do see that like there's a distinction here. He doesn't learn anything. He goes home and it's just, and it's another like crowd of people. His wife, you know, to her discredit, threw a surprise party because he came home from Cincinnati. Like, what is this going on? We just you know, there's this sort of nonsense to the way people are behaving towards one another in several contexts.
And to be honest, I mean, the main reason why to have a Charlie Kaufman episode, it had to be a film that you had not seen. So, I mean, I chose this one.
No,
it wouldn't have been the first one I would have chosen.
No, but I mean, this film was rapturously
reviewed.
It
was, yes.
This is another one
where... The puppet sex.
Yes, but this is one... I mean, maybe that was discussed, but I mean, I was looking at the IMDb page and like the critics are praising this as one of the year's best movies.
Yes.
It's so true. It's like, what are people living with?
I wonder if they're all male critics.
Yes, I think now that you mention it, I did try to like get in on the names.
So
this is the reverse of a movie like we just talked about, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, where, you know, people love it and critics are like, eh. Here it's the opposite. This is a critically acclaimed darling of a movie that people were just like, ugh. That's the way that it split for this one.
And speaking to the dream girl part of Charlie Kaufman, I'm thinking of anything's credit. It's very clever that it's from her perspective. It's her disdain for the man's imagination that she's in, right? So there's this constantly like self-effacing, self-deprecating thing that Charlie Kaufman does all the time.
Yes.
And
including in his kids' movie, which we'll get to.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's true. But with this, it's not really from her perspective. It's from this grumpy, you know, cynical man's perspective.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's very, to me, the reason why I enjoy it, I enjoy the faceless, like everyone is the same. I enjoy that aesthetically. And I think for me, what Anomalisa is, really does a good job with is its tech with the puppets. And I think people are often very drawn to that.
Yeah.
And I do think it's very, It has that, you know, that tactile kind of engrossing quality. Yeah.
And I think critics do gravitate towards films that just do things differently.
Yes. I do think it does.
Yes. It doesn't surprise me that it splits this way. And I mean, a lot of Charlie Kaufman, I mean, they loved Synecdoche, New York as well. I mean, critics, I think, really went for it.
No.
Really? No?
No. It's very divisive.
Really? Huh? Yes. Even
because
critically?
Because people feel like it's this overlong, monotonous epic.
There were people who were saying, like, maybe get someone else to direct your movies again.
Yes, exactly.
I think he didn't pivot to directing and stay there. So I think he does collaborate with people very productively.
Synecdoche, New York is a reach exceeds its grasp movie.
Fair enough.
If you rewatch it, but like even something like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind kind of goes on too long. Mm. I mean, it kind of wears out its welcome a little bit after a while. And I think in general, it is that kind of marrying, again, it's like emotional stakes with these kind of out there premises. And Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is very coherent in that way. Mm. So it's easier to get on board. It's just maybe you're like, okay, they can get back together now. We get the point. Yeah. Get out of the.
Well, see, I always find that kind of tragic at the end. It's like, oh, no, you don't want to do that. Why are you doing that?
It's better than Elijah Wood.
I get in the context of the movie, sure.
And then something as bleak as I'm thinking of many things is a nice, delightful, emotionally concise ending too.
Well, but it does put
a nice capper.
You go.
You understand what's going on. It's similar. Do you remember how Synecdoche, New York ends, by the way?
It's enormous. Insane.
There's like an apocalypse in his artwork.
Yes. Yes.
And then it all
comes tumbling down.
He's like, I'm
it?
Looking for meaning. I'm looking for something. I'm looking for meaning. And the woman on the other end of the phone goes, die. And so critics are like, what? Like, I'm thinking of anything.
Why
that's
do I
so...
suddenly want to go read Camus?
Yes. I'm thinking of anything that's so overt in the title.
Yeah.
It's
one
of the
first
things that she says. So you're sort of prepared for it.
Yeah.
Very Heideggerian, actually. Synecdoche, New York. The idea that your life's purpose is to die. Which is another. Charlie Kaufman is a very cheerful. Speaking of cheerful. I don't think you're prepared for how much I liked Orion in the Dark.
I am all ears.
It was so cool. It was such a cool movie. It really marries my sensibilities. I watched it with Atlas, Jim.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And he was a little trepidatious because it opens with all of these.
It's a little frenetic.
It's all these anxieties compounding
on
each
other. He is literally listing the things that make him anxious.
And scared, yes.
And scared. And it is like, this is how we know it's a Kaufman signature screenplay.
I've never felt seen.
This is adapted from a kid's book.
Yes.
And so you can sort of see like the grain of, I mean, kids' books are very basic.
Yes.
And so adapting a kid's book that has a very straightforward, like, you know, you meet the dark, you confront your fears. Like, it's that very basic sort of idea. But then the movie takes that basic idea and, like, of course, being Charlie Kaufman, layers five different things into it.
Yes.
In a way that I think does sort of spiral out a bit at the end.
But
the start of it is really just like, I have anxiety. Let me explain to you what scares the bejesus out of me.
I mean, like, him talking, not being able to talk to the
girl. Not being able to talk to, I mean, and again, there's Charlie Kaufman and the dream girl again. It's even in the kids' movie. Like, she seems perfectly normal.
Yes.
Like, anyway. Anyway, but it like when he goes to the bathroom, he's afraid of clogging the toilet and flooding the school.
Well, I had a similar anxiety, not about toilets.
Is that a common one?
Not about toilets, but I felt very connected to this guy. I felt very seen as Charlie Kaufman. In some ways, I identify with this kind of perpetual anxieties. But that was one where I was watering someone's lawn, and I thought I left the hose on, and so I imagined that I had flooded the entire house. So like taking things to such an ridiculous extreme.
Yes, catastrophic thinking. I think is the psycho.
And that's what this kid does.
Term. Yeah.
Yes, that he will get bit by a mosquito and his arm will rot off. And these things.
Yes, and he draws them.
Yes,
like so he sort of obviously he's been through a lot of therapy for his young age, and he has externalized.
To be clear, I didn't go through any therapy, and I turned.
But he has his notebook. He's got this documentation and so on. And there's the school bully, and you know, a very familiar sort of kids' movie setup. But it is just sort of introduced with this flair.
Yes.
and you know, the specificity that becomes very relatable, whether or not you relate to the specificity, like to the specific fear of flooding the school.
Well, I could tell that the movie technically would deal nicely with darker stuff. Like it was, I think the moment for me, yes, it maybe it's fairly conventional, but the somewhat morbid stuff about, like, yeah, being bit by a mosquito and your arm falling off, yes, and you seeing that, I'm like, okay, Atlas, how you doing, buddy?
He's a little younger than the target audience,
a little bit,
I think.
But he handled it pretty well. But as far as I can tell, but the girl at school, the bully, like, yes, these are things you would expect. But when one of his fears is when he goes back home and that his parents have left, and then you see him walk in and everything's gone, uh-huh, was such a, like, an inherent, just incredibly creepy visual.
Yeah.
Just for, as almost like a, you know, like a, you know, a visual representation of his fear. But it was just, and then suddenly the mom comes from behind the corner and goes, hi, honey. Mm-hmm. Like, that I could tell the movie was going to be playing with some stuff. But also he mentions his fear of nothing.
Yeah.
This existential dread thing.
It's the never-ending story,
yes,
again. But I mean, like, contained in a very different package.
And they never reference it, because it's such a, I mean, it would be such a difficult thing. It's so trite of him to say, like, this is my fear of nothing. It's represented by this closet opening up and everything being swallowed into it. Mm-hmm. But it's such a creepy, simple reflection of that fear. And I did have that fear.
It's a never-ending story.
Yeah, you're right. It's been a while since I've seen that movie.
Oh, man. Yeah. But that's like the big enemy is the nothing.
The sorrow is something else, right? That's the lake. Yeah.
The pit, is it the pit of despair? Yeah, something like that. Yes, we're really good.
Remember the horse.
Everyone within like 10 years of my age.
Yes.
It was traumatized by losing the horse.
I forgot about the nothing. Yeah.
Yeah, but no, the nothing is like the big baddie.
Okay.
In Never Ending Story. But that, of course, like, bink. It's like the light bulb going off when this movie does this too.
Yeah, but it doesn't make it's meant for you to kind of figure that out. That's the ultimate.
It is, I guess. Yeah, like it hadn't occurred to me that, like, you do kind of have to package existential dread for small children.
Yeah.
Because they're not immune from this.
No.
And they don't have language for this. So.
I should say I was never overtly afraid of the dark. I mean, as much as anyone else. I mean, I was afraid of the dark, but not in a, like, a very specific way.
Yeah.
But I like how the dark is just this kind of, hey, buddy, what's going on?
He's just a dude.
Yeah.
I kept thinking it was Seth Rogen, not. And I mean, it's one of those cases, especially with voice actors, I always end up doing this, like three times during the movie, like, are we sure this isn't Seth Rogen, IMDb? Like, no,
I didn't
it's
recognize
still
hardly
the other
any
guy.
Of the people.
Angela
the
Bassett was doing one, right?
She's the dream.
Yes,
dream
she's
one.
Just she's
purple.
Yes,
and of course the best one is purple, so I identified with that.
There you
go. But yeah, essentially, Dark is trying to show him that he should not be afraid of the dark, amongst other fears.
And it's take the neurotic kid to work with you day, apparently, for Dark and his buddies.
And they go out
and they have fun. If he finds real reasons to have existential dread instead of the ones that he's making up, and sorts it all out.
I think I also fundamentally really enjoy, like, cartoon depictions of these kind of just like feelings or
personifications.
Yes.
Of these
Inside Out does this very, very
well.
Yes. And I think I'm drawn to that. But the one I was telling Aleva about last night, because she unfortunately did not watch it. I did watch it with Atlas, but she had other stuff to do.
Well, is Atlas the kind of kid who will watch it five times before Saturday?
I hope so.
Okay.
Not necessarily now.
She'll have her chance, my point.
It'll be on Netflix. It's not going to go away, probably.
No.
But,
it is a Netflix joint. Did it get a theatrical release? I didn't look into it.
I have no idea. But I really liked Insomnia's design. Do you remember Insomnia's design?
Oh, yeah.
It's like a green
firefly-looking
bug thing.
And it goes,
who's balding. He's obviously very neurotic,
mm-hmm,
and he's wearing like a business outfit.
Yes.
But and what he does is he whispers horrifying fears into people's ears, which is great. But the detail that I thought, oh, that's so cool, is that his eyes are the digital numbers of an alarm clock. And it's like a parallel to, like, when you have insomnia, you're always looking at the alarm clock.
Yeah, yeah.
Time is constantly going
yep.
forward.
And it makes it worse.
It makes it worse. But it's also like screens, like digital
screens
being the thing that keeps you up, your phone keeping you up. And that's never referenced. Like, you know, Orion is not like, why are your eyes numbers or whatever?
No,
it's just
a
creepy, cool detail.
Yeah. This is the thing I think, too, that Charlie Kaufman excels at. Yes. Putting these that level of detail in everything, and there's so many of them, you don't have time to explain them. And if you miss one, doesn't matter. Like, three frames later, there will be another one. So it just they do end up getting overstuffed with these. And to their benefit, I think, especially for a movie like this one, for a kid's movie, you need this stuff because your kids will want to watch it again and again, especially if it's on Netflix and it's just going to live there. If you saw it and they liked it, there'll be a next time.
Yeah.
So there'll be more things to sort of pinpoint and say, like, isn't that cool? And really think about.
Like, I couldn't understand why Sleep, which is another one of these entities, had like a Russian accent. I couldn't understand why, where she was from in the world.
I mean, why not?
But the great dark bit where the way she puts people to sleep is she essentially kills them, or she chloroforms them and various other things. And I'm like, Atlas, maybe you look away for this joke. That feels very like, that felt like Kaufman intentionally putting in a dark joke.
Yeah.
Like, what is this, chloroform? This is the most awful thing. And then she put the baby to sleep and she brings out a hammer.
Oh, yeah.
Like, good God. So there's some stuff, but dark as a presence is always so affable. Like, it's clearly, clearly for children, but there's some cool surreal stuff, literally going into dreams.
Yes.
I'd be way into that.
Yeah. For kids, but there is enough, like, I mean, there were jokes I was laughing at that were not for the kids.
Because that is such a cynical thing that screenwriters do for children movies, like one for the kids, one for the adults.
No, but it's both, really, like throughout.
It feels very consistently one voice in that Charlie Kaufman way.
Yes.
My point is, it doesn't feel like he's pandering to one demographic or another.
So let's talk about the end, how he wraps this up.
Oh, sorry. I love, it's so cool. It's the nature of storytelling, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's so beautiful.
And this repeated storytelling.
Repeated storytelling for parents to do for their children. Obviously, I'm going to have a very specific connection to that now that I'm, you know. Atlas doesn't have any necessarily overt fears, but we're often trying to quell things that he's anxious about or trying to make him feel better about things. But it hasn't manifested as something as specific as the dark yet, though he does seem to be afraid of going down a hallway that's dark right now. But
Hallways are terrifying. I know Melissa understands this.
Closets.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
Empty spaces that you don't, the fear of the unknown.
Yeah. Liminal space.
But the storytelling conceit is so clever, and it's so meta in that fun Kaufman way.
Yeah. It is like a signature move.
But he's able to tie it back in emotionally. And this is what the familial, the story that you tell your children, and it gets passed down to their children and their children. And that is, and it's not, I'm thinking of ending things. It's something more hopeful and joyful.
Finally, we've waited how long?
and that I think that's what really sold it to me. But just the fun absurdity, like you mentioned, it goes off the rails. I love how it goes off the rails near the end, where essentially, not to spoil it, because I want people to watch it. He's telling the story to his child of himself as a kid. Right?
Yes.
And then he's like, well, why don't you come into the story? Or she says, why don't I come into the story and help?
Yes.
And he's like, okay, fine. And you're like, okay, that's cute. And she comes into the story and helps. And then it gets to this logic problem where him as a kid is talking to his daughter. And then
what do we do with this? And they have to like muddle through this narratively.
And then he goes, and it's just Charlie Kaufman having fun. Like, he's just like, well, how would this go?
Yeah.
And then he goes and tells his parents. He's like, oh, by the way, mom and dad, this is my daughter. And they're like, what? And he's like, no, I meant my friend. My friend. just like carrying this absurd, like fun, like seemingly incidental little thing for them to do. And carrying it out, and then without spoiling it, completely going off the rails for a good 10, 15 minutes before coming back to it, coming back to this emotional crux of it, which is about generations of storytelling that you do.
Well, and also it's the hope that you'll get over these fears. Like, there's a future for this. It's not going to swallow you up. I mean, which is, you know, when you start with here, I'm going to list my neuroses and show you how I've like unpacked this in therapy. Like, that does pass. Like,
yes.
It's, you know, and you can still be neurotic about other things, but like these are temporary. And I think that's reassuring too for kids.
Yes. It's very reassuring, but and also like friggin' environmental messages and global warming and so much other stuff he's just like cramming in there.
That's what we should really be anxious about. Yes. I feel like that's like, we're going to give you the real things that should terrify you and keep you up at night.
Traffic. And also being someone who enjoys the night, you know, I've always enjoyed. And so reflecting on the aesthetics of night and the dark and how you can see the stars. And it's just, it was so wonderful. Because Lev was doing other stuff. I said, if I had known this was been this good, I would have asked you over. Not that I don't trust your recommendations, Colleen, but I mean, Sea Beast, because it was being compared to all these other Netflix animated joints.
Which I have to say, to their credit, I mean, they
are better than you would think.
Yes, they have a decent track record overall, really. Yes. Between Leo, which came out not long ago, which I also recommended. My kids really liked it. Sea Beast, as we talked about in a previous episode. And now this, I mean, Netflix is picking decent projects here. And they're doing different things. They're breaking Disney's mold, you know, in very creative ways. Like, they're really supporting stuff that works. Yeah. In its own way, on its own terms. Like, why should
Kaufman being
for a kid's movie? Yeah. Who would have thought? So, I mean, really, yes, credit to Netflix for this very clearly curated collection of original kids' films.
And credit to you, Colleen, for bringing it to my attention.
Boy, well, thank you, Wickham. Your child is not like obsessively going, new film, because I mean, might have seen everything.
It was funny. He was watching it from the other side of the living room. And I said, Atlas, why don't you come sit over here and watch it? And I think he was taken aback by the anxiety of it. And he's like, no, you watch it. You watch it. And I'm like, Atlas, you're watching it too. And then eventually about halfway through, he came and sat with me. So it was very nice.
And drew his anxiety picture of Daddy makes me watch dark movies.
Maybe. Literally dark movies.
There you go.
I really loved it. I was shocked. I think it is this combination of factors that Charlie Kaufman's, his sensibility in general, like even the bleakness of I'm Thinking of Ending Things, like I enjoy that aspect of him, existential dread, as we've mentioned.
Yes.
So it was nice to see a version of that that captures also these other more, you know, kid-friendly aesthetics and even like that cross-generation stuff about storytelling. I was just not... Like, I care about the environment, too. It's like Charlie Kaufman made a movie directly with me in mind, it felt like. I don't know.
Oh, you are the target demographic.
I am Orion in the Dark, very specifically.
Can I tell you how I'm the target demographic?
Yeah.
It's like, so I think that this action is taking place in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
It might be Boston, but it's somewhere on the East Coast. And at one point, you know, Dark is flying over the continental U.S., and the first city that he flies over, one of the first cities, is Pittsburgh.
Aww.
And so I'm sitting there going, oh, it's Pittsburgh. I mean, literally, it's the Leonardo DiCaprio pointing moment. We're like, that's Pittsburgh. And my girls are like, what is going on? I'm like, yo, it's Pittsburgh.
I've had that's insomnia in Pittsburgh.
That's the bridge. I mean, to the point where I sat back down and everything was fine. And we watched the rest of the movie.
You stopped screaming about it. Yeah.
Put the kids to bed, and then I got it on my iPad. Like, there it is. And I think I took a picture and I sent it to you. Like, look, there it is. But it's a very nice little picture of Pittsburgh that's on.
At
for
night.
That, like, when darkness is falling, you know, night over Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh's got a great skyline. It's got one of the top, it has one of the top five skylines in the States.
I do enjoy aesthetically cities at night.
Yes. And so they did a good job with the design of them to say, like, for someone to be able to say, that's Pittsburgh. There's Chicago. Yes. So, you know, it does this sort of, you know, round the world geography placeness to the design that I think is really nice.
Oh, and also like the liminal spaces type thing.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that all of the spirits hang out in like gas stations.
Exactly.
Do you know what that is directly alluding to? Perhaps. What?
Maybe.
In Twin Peaks.
Oh, God.
the ancient.
Of course, we end up here.
Yeah, of course. The ancient spirits of Twin Peaks world, the entities, if you will, also like to hang out at the top of a gas station. So as soon as they go into the gas station, and it's like, oh, here's this guy, and I don't know what they're doing. They're playing cards.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
I was thinking like, oh, he's doing a Twin Peaks thing, and then I think they go to Shanghai and then Dreams is like. Oh, they have good tea here, and they go to the equivalent of a gas station type place there.
Or like a tea so house or something.
I felt like that was a direct nod to Twin Peaks.
Yes. Yeah. The break time for the personifications was really quite cool.
Because there's something about it's very memorable in Twin Peaks because of this movie that's so crazy, and there's a mystery, and there's all this stuff. And there's the simplicity of like, oh no, they hang out at the top of the gas station.
And it's break time. Yeah. You know, labor rights are also important. We need to inculcate this mentality in our children as well.
That's what causes the rift. Is they're like darkness, you've been leading us astray. Like fact that he has to give a speech on behalf of darkness and he messes up, that also felt very like middle management, yes. like Kaufman-y too.
Yeah.
It was great.
Yeah. And the guy coming after, the daytime guy, I can't remember
how
they call it, but he's just a jerk.
Well, no, he's got sunglasses. He's like, coming through, here I come.
Yes, he is the Kaufman foil. For sure.
Was it a reference to when he's on the sea turtle? Is that a Stephen King reference? The fact that we're all in a sea turtle's dream?
Maybe. Yeah.
Okay.
That I wouldn't felt be surprised.
Odd. That came out of nowhere.
Well, isn't that like some sort of Native American mythology? The world is carried on a turtle's back.
That's right.
I'm not sure what tribe that comes from, but Stephen King would have taken that
for It, maybe.
Randomly. Really?
That would explain the evil clown, too.
What?
There's an evil clown reference throughout Orion, too.
Did I? Okay, we were in the city. Speaking of evil clowns, there was a building in Ankara. This is a total digression, but there's a building
in Ankara.
The facade of the building is a clown. We drove past this and I was like, wow. My daughters were like, what? Clown? Pointing out.
Do you have a fear of clowns?
No, but I have a fear of this building. Who designed this?
I don't know. What sort of? You need to send me a picture of it.
I didn't even want to put it on my phone. Honestly, it's like, this is cursed. I want nothing to do with this. And when we left where we were, the girls were like, "Can we go a different way? We don't want to see the clown again."
It's distracting while you're driving.
I wasn't driving, thankfully. Okay. I mean, I was just sort of watching because we don't go into the city all that often, and this was a neighborhood that we don't know.
Was it like a fun park or something?
No, it was just a building
with a clown on it.
With a clown as the facade, like the eyes or windows, like
that is horrifying.
It is. It is. It's horrifying. I don't know. Do you know what building I'm talking about? I swear this is real. I don't want my phone to be haunted.
You don't want to show it.
No.
My favorite way of doing haunted clown stuff, I think they did this in Florence, is you just tie, it's directly related to It, but you just tie a red balloon next to a sewer.
Well, that's
very cheap and effective way of making people terrified.
Yep, there you go.
But maybe there's like a weird Stephen King.
I wonder if people do that to the sewer right in front of that clown.
Just to say, we don't appreciate this. But it's also like the building can eat you, right? It's huge. So the clown face can consume you.
That's the one. That's the one. That's it. That's it.
That is it's terrifying. Unsettling.
Where did you find that, Adnan? You Googled it? Ankara clown? Okay. It has a name?
Pennywise.
Pennywise building?
Clown firm.
I can't imagine that the architect picked that. Or maybe they did.
Maybe they're
know.
Just big clown fans.
I.
They exist.
And this is right next to a school. Imagine that.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being on the bus driving past that every day? That kid is going to have anxiety.
He's going to have these fears. He's going to be Orion.
Just really. Anyway.
Anyway.
I am thrilled to hear that you liked this
really
as much
liked
as you
it.
Did.
Yeah. It's probably my favorite film I've seen this year. So
oh,
far.
Wow. Yeah, yeah. Wow. Okay.
Just because it captured the essence of things that I like about Kaufman and children's movies. And it didn't feel like, it wasn't pandery. It was more, it had more on its mind. And I was not expecting him to tie in again his absurd, surreal meta inclinations, taking things to the ridiculous extent, which to being John Malkovich's credit, really goes for it in a way. But it was not emotionally satisfying.
Right.
And this was emotionally satisfying.
This reminds me of Adaptation in that it is an adaptation that so far exceeds the source text.
Well, same with I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
And
too.
It doesn't, but it doesn't. I mean, I don't know the source text for I'm Thinking of Ending Things. I don't know that relationship. It's not a relationship that he really foregrounds in the movie. But obviously, like when you're adapting a kid's book for a feature-length film, you've got to invent stuff.
Yeah, yeah. That's
and
true.
The same thing, the Susan Orlean stuff in Adaptation, like he's going so far beyond what the book is in order to make the movie that he made. Like, it's the same thing here, obviously.
Well, I guess, and I have not read Orion the book, but it's probably similar to his notebook, right?
I don't know.
Orion has a notebook in the movie that chronicles all of his fears and things.
Yeah.
And it has all these specific drawings. There's probably a foregrounding of that types of illustrations. We should look that up.
Yeah.
How much of the designs, for example, are taken from the book?
Yeah, I think a lot of the character designs are taken from the book. At least like the Dark looks very similar. But I mean, I don't think that it's nearly as fleshed out in the book. It's just, you know, we have the little illustrations and the story happening. But it's, I mean, it doesn't look like it's a chapter book or anything. It's just
a
picture book.
Not to tie everything together. Do you think that Anomalisa, he was just more driven by the tech and he just kind of wanted to come up with a simple story?
I guess, maybe. I mean,
it feels so, maybe it was also the backlash to Synecdoche. It could have been. I think this is what he did after Synecdoche. He's like, okay,
fine. Pare it all down.
I'll do a simple thing in a hotel room. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though obviously it's not simple. It's this incredibly complicated animated thing.
It is. And I mean, stuff does sort of risk getting super complicated when he goes down into the bowels of the hotel. We didn't talk about that scene. And he meets the guy.
I've completely forgotten this. Yes.
I mean, yeah, but it's just, this is where things get weird. Like, you know that there's a twist coming. And then, but the way that he, that staged, like there's with the meeting pit in this guy's giant, weird, dark office. Like stuff is just not what it should be. In this situation, but it doesn't end up.
It doesn't amount.
No,
to anything.
It doesn't amount to anything in the end, and then you just think, no, this guy's just a jerk.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of what you're
this
left.
This guy's
with.
Just a jerk. That's all. Yeah, yeah. No, I side with Olive here.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
I don't blame you. I think her read on it is very like you can't say that that's not true.
Because even the fun, cool visual stuff of like, yeah, everyone looks the same. It's again a justification, right? It's a way of justifying his
and
his
giving
bad
Tom
actions.
Noonan a really complex thing to chew on as an actor.
Yeah. I like Tom Noonan.
Yeah, sure. No, nothing against him, but like he's got a lot to do.
I like David Wallace too.
Yes. But I mean, the whole movie is basically on Tom Noonan selling us however many characters he's playing, which is at least a couple dozen.
While mildly creeping you out at the same time.
Exactly. No, we talked about like the one person credits of All Is Lost. It's Robert. Here it's three people.
Yeah.
And literally it's you know, David Thewlis, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and then Tom Noonan as everyone else. That is what is written in the credits. That is what is on IMDb. That is like, that's a power credit right there. I mean, if that's
I was
not
everyone
the
else
CV,
in this movie, yeah.
Yeah,
speaking
I was
of
everyone
credits,
else. Yes.
Dark's film. Dark. I know you were referencing this.
Dark's film.
Dark has a film.
Yes, there's a cameo at the beginning, I told you.
Yes. Narrated
but no, don't, by, don't, no, don't. Don't spoil the cameo.
With
don't
titles,
spoil the cameo.
With titles by
Saul
Bass.
Yes. That we can spoil. These are the like, jokes where I was laughing hysterically and my girls were just confused.
And he says something like, and it wasn't even accepted into Sundance.
Yes.
That feels like Charlie Kaufman is
getting something off of his chest. Yeah. I mean, shout out too, to Charlie Kaufman during the writer's strike.
Oh.
Did you see like the very impassioned speech that he gave? He was all in with the strike and just, I mean, really defending the craft of writing and the practice of writing.
I mean, it makes
he
sense.
He is a writer's
would,
writer,
yeah,
for
it would,
sure.
It would make sense he would have that perspective.
Yes, yes. So.
I'm a big fan. If you're, it's that very specific Kaufman vibe that I sort of convolutedly explained at the beginning of this that I think I very much enjoy. I think I will look forward to anything he makes. And I guess more overtly, these children's properties. It's almost like by appealing to a different demographic, I'm reminded of maybe Fantastic Mr. Fox or something.
Mm.
It appeals to almost something like he's not overburdening it. Like, I don't know. There's something more. I don't know. Is there a connection there of like when you're appealing to children, you're appealing to something kind of more universal or more? I don't know how I'm sounding.
No, yeah, I don't know about universality, but I think it is like I need to convey the crux of my vision.
As a writing exercise, yeah.
Yeah, in a way that you know, that will speak to more people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, obviously, Anomalisa is not doing
that. No. It doesn't speak to really the people that he's trying to speak to.
Yeah,
it spoke to critics,
I don't know about
I guess.
That. Yes, yeah. Critics. I mean, really, the language that people use to talk about Anomalisa just, what's their problem?
Cool puppets.
Cool puppets.
But yeah, similar like Wes Anderson, what he brought to Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah.
In a similar sort of. His sensibility.
But I mean, Wes Anderson doing a kid's movie is not really that far a cry, honestly.
Right. I mean, Charlie Kaufman is.
Charlie Kaufman, I'm thinking of the yes. For as
a children's film.
For as explicit as he is about especially sexual neuroses and making that very often like the crux of his characters. Like to do a kid's movie, it's like, okay, how are you going to do this? How is that going to play in a like, kid-centric world? And he does a great job.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think Anderson had to do it. He, instead of swear words, it's what the cuss. And frankly, that's genius, the way he did that. Yes. But yeah, Kaufman has to really rethink, like, how is this all going to come together? And I think having something to adapt is helpful. Same with Wes Anderson. I mean, who also goes well beyond the source text. I don't know if you've read Dahl's Fantastic Mr. Fox lately, but my God, it really just exceeds what's in there and does so within his own set of personal neuroses.
We should also mention, by the way, Charlie Kaufman did not direct this. He just wrote it.
No.
So the director deserves a lot of credit as well.
Of course, yeah. I mean,
if we knew his name right now, we would be able to say that.
We would. And I'm going to keep talking while you look it up. But I'm wondering, too, if like the animation in Netflix is done by the same team or if they're getting different teams in on it.
Well, that's a good question. Sean Charmads.
How is that spelled? That can't be right.
That sounds like
Sorry,
a Pokemon.
Mr. Charmads.
Charmads. He did a SpongeBob. He wrote for SpongeBob SquarePants.
Oh.
And he was the director of one of like a Trolls holiday special. This is his first big directorial feature.
Well. Hats off.
Good job, Sean.
Yeah.
It's nice. You did a good job with that.
Yeah.
Script and the visuals and everything.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Sounds good. All right. I will send us out.
Sounds good.
Because I don't have a special thanks.
Oh.
So this is my way of dodging that.
Oh. That means I have to come up with one.
Yeah.
Okay.
In the time I have.
Okay.
To speak.
Right.
That's our episode. You Made Me Watch That is a production of the Department of Communication Design at Bill Kent University. You can support the podcast by subscribing and reviewing with your favorite audio app and by following us on Instagram at ymmwt.podcast under the direction of our social media managers, Noor Sakiana. How did you pronounce her last name?
Sakaina.
And Zeynep Aras. Our cover art was designed by Denise Vadi Tunger. Our theme music was composed by Dazi Ozovsky. Check out more of his music wherever you get your fine audio. This episode was recorded by Adnan Shahin. Am I pronouncing that correct? No?
Nothing.
What?
Nothing. No.
Edited by Tylan Ockel and produced by Tylan Ockel and the Bill Kent Cinema Society, whose coming attractions you can find on Instagram at Bill Kent Cinema. We conclude with extra to Shekular to our tech wrangler, Ostrander Carr, and our team of student volunteers whose work will be coming your way throughout the season. Do you have any special thanks?
Thank you to the architect responsible for the Pagliaccio House in Ankara for sowing dreams and nightmares.
Hey.
We salute you, crazy architects.
If people's fears and anxieties can lead to such beautiful inspirations and connections between families throughout generations, then they are a worthwhile thing.
Mommy, can we not drive past the clown? It's going to live in my head rent-free. Thank you, Wickham.
Thank you, Colin.